Okay, if we can begin, I think this evening we'd like to go through the testimony we didn't get a chance to get to, and Representative Carlson, we've talked over scheduling over these next couple of days. Obviously, there's some uncertainty in terms of we have Senate Finance, House Ways and Means. We're having committee scheduled floor sessions. I'm not sure how this ever happened today, but the Senate session went longer than the House. We were embarrassed over that and apologize. But
Started later.
That's true, Representative Murphy. So at any rate, we're getting a later start today than we had expected, but we'd like to go through the testimony. We're going to have some suggestions for conferees today, tomorrow. We've been working hard on some of these language issues. We also know that some of the working groups have been working. I guess that's redundant, isn't it, to some extent? So as we proceed through the night, or not the night, but over these next couple of hours, we will talk to the conference committee about what we expect. So let's pick up from where we left off. Although I just want to make sure we've had a list promulgated by staff, by Jane and Joanna, relative to people who would like to testify. But I want to make sure, is there anybody here from either the university or Minsku? I'm not sure who wanted to speak. Okay. Let's start out with Secretary of State Mark Ritchie. Mr. Secretary, welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Mark Ritchie, Secretary of State. I first want to thank you for this incredible hard work that you're having to do to bridge this gap. I've been able to watch and follow as closely as I can and very much appreciate that this is difficult and you're doing a very fair and thorough job. Of course, for our office, like every other office, we're trying to evaluate what will these cuts imply, especially in a year that's going to be a record year for elections, and also a year where we're seeing where our business services side is going to be and already has been seeing a record amount of volume because of the unevenness and the disruptions in the economy. So we're going to face more demands, and we're obviously going to have fewer dollars to meet those demands. And so we're in the process of thinking it through very clearly. We understand that all of us together have to face this problem and address it, and we are ready to do our part in that process. But we also know that Minnesotans expect us to stay number one in elections and that this year we will be, under the national spotlight. And so a lot of people are going to be watching what happens here. And so we need to make sure. And to do that with less dollars, we're going to have to be more creative, be very committed and very focused. That's what our staff is committed to doing. I would like to thank you again for your work in doing this. I know it's not hard on your end. I wanted to make it clear to you that we understand our responsibilities and ready to shoulder our part of that responsibility, and wanted to take any questions that anyone might have in terms of how our office is beginning to approach this as well. Clearly, a 3% cut is a much easier blow for us than 4%, but in a year that we know there'll be heavy demand, we're going to have to be quite careful and quite cautious to make this work out. So thank you again, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Rukavina.
Well, Mr. Chair, and Secretary of State Ritchie, I understand, the pressures, because I hope it is, as you say, a record election year, which I'm hoping and I'm kind of sure that it will be too. But, Mr. Chair, members, I understand, there's a little bit of fluff in the Secretary of State's budget in that he's able to hire a Deputy Secretary of State. And so
I think we can save some money there?
I think we could save some money there, and I don't know at this time if I intend to tonight offer an amendment that prohibits him from doing that, but I'm seriously considering it, and I was just wondering what your comments might be on that, Secretary of State Ritchie.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, perhaps you could put an exemption in for tall white males who used to work for Iron Rangers, and we could kind of call it even.
Well, for those who don't know what I'm talking about, which most people usually don't know what I'm talking about anyhow. But my committee administrator, today was his, actually yesterday was his last day, and he's going to work for Mr. Ritchie, and I congratulate you for getting a top-notch, exceptional person for the job, but I will be taking this out on you at some time and place at a later date. So.
Well, if we can save some money in the budget, I'd like to do it right now, if it's possible. President Carlson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I got to know his new staff person. I office just down the hall from him, and you made a good choice.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay. Other questions, maybe of a more genial nature for the Secretary of State? Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Okay. Then is Auditor Otto, yes, right in the front.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll be very brief, as I know that's what you like. State Auditor Rebecca Otto, and I'm with Matt Lindemann, is with me here today from our office as well, if there's any particular questions. Some of you have heard what the supplemental budget bill proposed cuts will do to our office, but I want to just do a quick review. What we're doing is handing out the fastest packet in the world, just a couple of visuals for you. Not everyone always knows what our office does. We oversee the spending of over $20 billion a year, which is actually more than the OLA, spent by local governments. And we do this through auditing, investigating, reporting, and educating. For fiscal year 2009, I have a quick pie graph or pie chart here for you that shows that 85% of our costs we recover through fees and reimbursements. So we have almost no impact on the general fund as an office. So 15% of our budget is comes from the general fund and has impact. It's $1.4 million. Realize we're a very small office. There's another graph I'd like you to take a look at. It's a bar graph, and this is the most instructive part of it. It has all of our divisions on this page. So there's blue bars and there's some gray there. The blue is the dollar amounts that we recover through fees and reimbursements. The gray is where we don't. That's the impact we have in the general fund. I'm really thankful that the House and Senate are on the same page in terms of $42,000 as a cut to our office. That's great. I just want you to see where that might come from. Constitutional office is me. And that's not, you know, we don't get fees and reimbursements for that. I serve on six state boards, one of them being State Board of Investment, $62 billion, MHFA, lots of money, a lot of important boards, Para Board for pensions. And I've got a general counsel who comes out of that, too, who is my designee and who has to be there for me because of our service. We get served for MHFA. Legal and special investigations is one of the other major divisions. And as you can see, that the budget's not very big. I want to let you know that that's probably where it comes from, the cut that you're proposing. I want to let you know that in an economic downturn, actually what happens is fraud and misuse of funds goes up. And we have something that comes into the office called 609 reporting, where local government officials are required to report to our office if they are aware, if they have evidence of misuse of public funds or theft or fraud. Our calls have doubled. From the same period last year to this year, we've had a doubling or 100% increase in the 609 reporting. It is an economic downturn. There are some crimes of opportunity occurring. Realize when locals have to cut back, they might lose some internal controls. So in an economic downturn, typically oversight, actually the spending is increased, not decreased. And so again, I'm thankful that it's as small as it is, but realize in an office of my size, it has quite an impact. And we really strive in our office to get back to local officials when they call in and or the public when they suspect misuse of funds. This makes it more difficult for us to get back in a timely manner. We have one person doing this work, and we have tons of calls and letters and emails coming in that we have to get on top of. And so I just want you to know the impact it'll have. The very last chart is that 90% of our budget is people. We don't own buildings. We lease one. Our communications costs are down to 1%. We don't print reports unless they're asked for, except for some of the libraries. Communications, okay, small. Travel, 1%, and we cover the whole state. So, again, you wanted to know the impact. I'm thankful that you're on the same page. I wish we could be adding right now because there is a demand, and we really try to help local governments be good steward of public funds, but in order to educate them, which we work on as well, it takes people. So I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Representative Murphy.
Thank you. Auditor Otto, which those 609s, which category are they in on page
that,
four?
Thank you. That, Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that is legal and special investigations. So that's the second bar. And none of that is currently, we don't get fees or reimbursements. Part of the reason why we don't get that is because we want local officials to be able to report misuse of public funds. If they thought there was going to be a financial implication for them to reporting, and let's say they're already in financial trouble, they're not going to call because they'll think, oh, it's going to cost us. We don't charge for our work in that area.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Otto, which one of these categories does the colored Xeroxing come from?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy and members, the color Xeroxing, we only made enough copies for the committee. Our office, under my administration, I've cut paper costs by a tremendous amount. Past administration sent out reports to all kinds of people, and I think you all used to get paper reports. We only do that when requested. And even for the Pension Commission, Representative Murphy, we normally give paper reports, and we were happy to do that. We'd also be happy to just send an electronic copy if that is okay with your commission. So this is to help you all see what's going on. And it's a very, and actually for our printing costs, we have contracted with vendors that help keep our costs very, very low. So,
Mr. Chair, we're not used to seeing things in color, lots of pages in color.
Well, and I guess when we cut more of the House budget, it'll be tougher.
Senate, does the Senate have a color printer?
Look at that.
Well, there's one first place to cut.
Further questions for Auditor Otto? Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm not sure. Is there somebody here from the Attorney General's office who wish to testify?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Rebecca Spartz. I'm the Director of Administration for the Attorney General's Office. I have very brief comments, and then I would be happy to answer questions. The Attorney General appreciates the very difficult task you have in front of you, and she understands that every part of state government has to be part of the solution. Obviously, we would appreciate the 3% cut rather than the 4% that the governor set out for us. We provide a service to state agencies and others, and consequently, 85% of our budget is salary. So with a 3% cut, the Attorney General is going to have to very, very carefully review how we provide services, the services that we are providing, and then she'll have to determine which positions need to be eliminated, and if we can save money by actually holding positions open, that would be the other method that we would resort to. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Spartz, how many open positions do you have right now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, currently we have 8 open positions, and we've been interviewing for the last 2 weeks because a number of them are in our public protection area, particularly the area where we deal with civil commitment of sexual psychopaths. And so, yes, right now we have 8.
And, Mr. Chair, Ms. Spartz, but you're interviewing for those jobs, and so this, if you were, I mean, I thought you said that you would try to do this work by holding positions open, but those positions might not be open by the time we finish the budget.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, the positions that we do need to fill are ones that are typically in public protection because we handle the civil commitment hearings, and that takes up a large part of any attorney's time, and we can't get behind, because if we get behind and don't show up, someone could be released. The other people in public protection around the state, they do prosecute the felony drugs and also murder cases. And currently we have three people out of the office in Greater Minnesota doing exactly that. So I think from the perspective of our office, we do have to cover the areas where it's public protection. And then there may be other areas where we simply will either be a little slower in delivering a service, or we'll have to figure out a way to handle that.
Sarah Betzel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Sparks, are all eight positions in the public protection area that you've described, or are there some in other areas?
Mr. Chair, Senator Betzel, no, they're not. We have some positions that are funded by what is called partner agreements, and each year we talk to those agencies, and they try to determine how many hours of legal services they're going to need in that next coming year. So consequently, we have a demand there for us to provide the services to an agency. It may be that we have to very carefully look at how we're going to provide it or whether we're going to provide the service.
Mr. Chair, could your office provide us, the conference committee, or at least maybe Representative Kahn in my offices, with a list of those positions that are open that may or may not be filled in?
Okay.
Thank you.
Further questions for Ms. Parts? Okay. Well, thank you very much. Next on the list was Mr. Rubenstein from the Humanities Commission. Was he? Okay. Apparently he's not here. Commissioner Badgerow from Department of Administration.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. I'm Dana Badgerow, the Commissioner of Administration, and I do appreciate, we're all kind of starting to sound like a broken record, but I do appreciate the opportunity to join with my fellow agency heads and explain some of the issues with either the House or the Senate versions of the bill. It sounds as though maybe we only have issues. First, I do want to underscore that we in the Department of Administration are more than willing to accept and implement our fair share of the budget deficit solution. To that extent, the 2% operating reduction in the House looks fairly attractive. However, there are a couple of strings associated with that 2% that I do think merit some further discussion. Let me first put the agency in context. Much like several others that you've heard from, our general fund is really very small. It's only about $11.9 million. Most of our budget is recovered through fees charged to agencies for the services that we provide, like leases and fleet and so forth. So of the $11.9 million, most of that is to perform our statutory, I'll call them compliance functions, or those functions that are more enterprise-wide in nature, such as, for example, facilities, parking, fleet, workers' compensation, claims management, risk, insurance. The enterprise-wide functions in our compliance functions are more like contract management, data practices, oversight, and so forth. So for the 4% reduction that was in the governor's budget, we will reduce positions. In our energy management group, we will hold others open. We will reduce recycling supplies, and we will reduce our professional contracts. But we can do that, I think, without hampering any of our oversight roles and without passing costs on to other agencies. See, the nature of our agency is that we provide services for the so-called line agencies, and if we don't provide those services, they'll do them themselves, oftentimes much less efficiently and much less effectively. So the issues in the bills, in relative priority order, the first is the fact that the Senate eliminates the Office of Strategic Planning and Results Management. That's a budget line item of $335,000. So when you bring That reduction, together with a reduction in a grant that the Senate takes, our operating cut is actually 8% of base. So I think we may be leading the pack among agencies in that respect. There was no testimony about the function of this Office of Strategic Planning and Results Management, so if you'll permit me, I'd like to just briefly describe what that office does. First, it is the home of our quality improvement or lean enterprise activities, where we are offering to state agencies, 12 pilot agencies in fact, tools and techniques by which they can improve their processes, take out waste in those processes, and actually get more done with fewer people and fewer resources. These 12 agencies that have signed up for this program that is being administered out of this office include, for example, the Department of Health, which has reduced the time it takes to issue a birth certificate from 7 days to one. Most interestingly, I heard the Vets Home Board testify the other day. They're very, very eager to implement Lean. One of the projects they're looking at is the more effective and perfect administration of medications to their patients at the Minneapolis Board. Those are the kinds of process improvement projects that this office is lending to state government. But in addition, the office has its responsibility for managing the performance results websites of all state agencies. Now, you may not even know that exists, but there is, if you go to the governor's website, a set of goals and objectives for this administration, each of which is then linked to a separate agency who has goals and objectives that relate up to those particular goals. In fact, if you read our somewhat dubious grading the state's grade, this results management system was one of the items that was called out. Now, you all may not know it exists, and maybe many of your counterparts do not, but it is an active website. There are over 500 visits to that website every day where people are spending in excess of 5 minutes going through and looking at agency goals and objectives and results. Now, most recently, we've been working with agencies to try to refresh those goals and make them more relevant. And, for example, we are working with MnDOT currently to update their goals so that they more relate to infrastructure management. By the way, Senator Clark has an initiative to resurrect Minnesota Milestones, which we very much support. And I think the correlation of these goals and objectives that departments are currently keeping with the old milestones will get us a step ahead as we implement that project. Then finally, this was the office that did manage the response to the Grading the States effort. So that's issue one. Issue two is that in the House, while we receive only a 2% reduction, there is language that fences off from the cut the Environmental Quality Board and the Land Management Information Center, which means effectively that $1.6 million out of our budget is insulated from cuts. If the 4% in the Senate and the fenced language, we have to find another way to actually find the $227,000 that would be cut from those operations. So I don't know what else I can do. I've looked at some options if we are unable to take the reduction from those two activities, and they're not pleasant. One would be we might have to reduce central mail deliveries. We may have to reduce or eliminate capital complex recycling. We might be faced to reduce the staff of our data practices office, which is already small, and by the way, did just have a layoff because it was underfunded in the last biennial budget. We might have to reduce the number of people assigned to monitor contracting. We have the demographer and state archaeologist that might have to sustain some reduction. Or we could simply not do the services and let state agencies negotiate their own leases or manage their own construction projects. So what I'm really suggesting is that we're more than willing to take our 4% reduction, but we really do need to take it across our entire $11 million base for it to be fair. Now, with respect to Land Management Information Center, it is a wonderful operation. They do fabulous work, much revered by counties and cities and others across the state. The reduction that would be taken in Land Management Information Center would restore them to their 2006 base, because the legislature in the last biennial budget gave them a bit of a bonus, and all this would do would be restore them to an equitable position with the rest of the operations in the department. Issue number three. There is, in the governor's programs, a veterans contracting preference. This is not funded in the Senate, and it is funded at the level of $88,000 in the House. The governor had requested $185,000, but frankly, the governor's program covered all vets from all time. The $88,000 would be what it would take to implement a preference in contracting for vets of the Gulf War era. That's probably a more appropriate and reasonable approach in any way. My only message there is it's an important program for the governor. If the language stays, we need the money to implement the program because these companies need to be registered and certified. If we're going to give any firm a 6% edge in state contracting, we need to make absolutely sure that it is veteran-owned. We need to understand their ownership, interests, and so forth. So we have a program that we have established for minorities and women-owned businesses, and we would have to do the same kind of certification and registration here. I will comment briefly on the facility repair and replacement. That's FR&R, for those who are not familiar with the lingo. That's a fund in our building account with a current balance of $5.8 million. We take money from the leases that all state agencies pay to us, and we set it aside for repairs and betterments, emergencies, ADA compliance, asbestos, and so forth. The House takes $2 million out of that account, and the Senate takes $1.5 million. That's fine. We understand the issues and that you need the money. I just need to tell you that we will be deferring two projects because of either the $1.5 million or the $2 million. One is an air quality improvement in the Judicial Center, and the other is such a similar project in the Centennial Office Building. These are valve box upgrades that are control systems that will improve energy efficiency and air quality. Both of those will have to be deferred. Then finally, I would like to comment just briefly on the provision that reduces professional and technical contracts across all state agencies. Basically, these are, as you all know, not trivial and sometimes are quite essential. For example, let me just say that in 2006, that was $367 million in professional and technical contracts across all state agencies. But they included building and bridge designs, architects and engineers, court reporters, employee drug tests, translators, computer security experts, dentists and doctors, major systems like the system you heard about the other day for the Department of Vehicle Services. That will be a professional technical contract, no doubt. So I think with an indiscriminate cut, an across-the-board cut, the most practical way for the Department of Finance to allocate that will be simply on the basis of the professional and technical contracts that each agency has. I just ran a quick review of what that would mean in our own agency, but it would be an additional $321,000 of cuts. So if you added all that up, every single conceivable cut in both the House and the Senate side of the Department of Administration, we'd be looking at a 13% reduction. So quite frankly, Mr. Chair and members, the 4% looks really good.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner. Let me just ask a question about the contract language. I just asked Mr. Mossman to remind me that the total amount of general fund dollars in the contracts is approximately $85 million. Maybe that $5 million figure in the Senate bill might be a little bit high, but that would be about 6%. Now, the governor is cutting 4% across the board in the agencies, and so I'm wondering why there would not be So I think the feeling on the part of the Senate was that if we had agency cuts, we could also look at vendors outside of the agencies, and possibly there's an opportunity to renegotiate contracts if a vendor is so interested in contracting with the state of Minnesota for whatever service, that in a time when we don't have the general fund dollars available, and in a time when the economy is having some difficulty, it's possible that those vendors would be willing to negotiate contracts at a lower figure to continue the contract. I mean, certainly you look at home contracting right now. Home contractors are significantly reducing prices they charge in order to get the work. So I don't know if there's the ability to simply negotiate on a somewhat tougher basis.
Mr. Chair, I'm glad you mentioned negotiations. One of the things that we do with the general fund money that we were allocated for our contracting area is to establish a negotiations unit. That unit this last year saved $13 million just by better negotiations. So we are already putting a significant emphasis on negotiations. I think it, to me, would be problematic to reopen contracts midterm without some other change in scope and demand reductions in price. I think the important point here is these are services that are not discretionary. They are not trivial. They are important services, professional and technical contract services that are, again, for example, linked heavily to the bonding bill. I estimate that the bonding bill alone will require $40 million worth of architects and engineering services. That's just my rough estimate.
Well, Commissioner, let me address that because you raised something I was going to raise. In fact, I misstated the amount. I asked Mr. Mouston to check, and the figure is actually $182 million. So the cut to the contracts would be 2.7%, so actually significantly less than the percentage of cut suggested to the agencies. But let's talk about architectural services. Home construction, as everybody knows, has collapsed. Other kinds of construction has been significantly impaired. I can only assume, I don't know this for a fact, but I can only assume that architectural firms are having difficulty. So if it's a question of contracting with a particular architectural firm relative to bridge design, maybe they'd be willing to accept when they submit, if an RFP is put out and they submit a bid of X number of dollars, ask them if they would take 2.5% less. And in a time like this, how do we know that they would not do that?
Mr. Chair, we do that, in fact, on obviously requests for proposal as opposed to requests for bids, which we do request for proposals on a best value basis. The very first thing we do once we've selected the best value is we sit down with that vendor and negotiate the price and terms. And that's where we have achieved significant success. One of my favorite stories is when the Secretary of State was buying HAVA compliant voting equipment. We sat down with that vendor and negotiated a $1 million price reduction in that contract, which enabled seven more counties to buy HAVA equipment. So we are, I guarantee you, we are spending a lot of effort on negotiating contracts. I think the important point here is that it simply is an additional across-the-board cut for all agencies, no matter how they implement it. And in many cases, let me be really frank here. I mean, we are losing key employees every day, either to retirement or to better paying jobs. We want to retain every single state employee that we can. So when we get a 4% reduction, as we will get from this bill, the very first place we look is to our contracting. And in the case of Department of Administration, at least $70,000 of the cut that we would absorb would be in a contract reduction. So we've already taken reductions, at least in our department, in the contracting area because we would rather do that than lay off employees.
Well, Commissioner, I would certainly applaud you for that. If we go back to the HAVA contract, I don't know what the total contract was.
$13 million.
$13 million. Mm-hmm. And the negotiation was apparently the original bid was $14 million. You negotiated $1 million less.
For the same scope.
Okay. So what happens if you negotiate 2% less than that?
Well, we do our best, Mr. Chair.
Well, and that's what we're trying to do, and that's what we need to ask you to do. I apologize for using, because I know that you've done obviously a first-rate job as commissioner both with this administration and with Governor Carlson's administration. So I apologize for just using you as the example, but since you're sitting there, I did this a little bit with the courts, an area of the budget that I've been extremely engaged in over the last number of years. You're talking about the inability to retain employees, the difficulty of the 4% cut. It's interesting that we're hearing this from agency after agency after agency. You can't cut anymore. We can't absorb any more cuts. We're already cut to the bone. We can't provide these services. Have any of you gone to the governor to say maybe we need a little bit more revenue to actually do the work we're supposed to be doing? Why come to us?
Well, Mr. Chair, let me be real clear about I am more than willing to absorb the 4% either through productivity or other means. The 4% is, I'm not whining one bit about it. I think it's only fair that we take our fair share of the budget reduction. My issues are with some of the things that pile on top of that, which make it really, really difficult for us to do a number of services that I described.
Well, I don't disagree that this budget is certainly, maybe I've used this before, the cliche of, the round peg in the square hole. I wouldn't disagree with that whatsoever, but I do find it interesting that every commissioner feels that the legislature is picking on them, and obviously that's not something we like doing, but we have some priorities within our the budgets we're preparing, and it's not a perfect world. So again, unfair to use yourself, but I would certainly suggest that maybe the commissioners ought to go to the governor and say this just isn't working out. We can't sustain this anymore. Certainly, if you can't sustain this year, wait till next year. And that round peg in the square hole is going to be even rounder, with the square hole being even smaller. Further questions for Commissioner Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Bajero, tell me more about that mail system that you were talking about that I didn't understand.
Well, when I look at across my department, there are very few activities that are funded with the general fund. One of them happens to be central mail delivery. The delivery of mail in and around the Capitol complex, the pickup of inter-office mail and the pickup of U.S. mail that is then sometimes stamped, posted, and then delivered to the United States Post Office. The United States Post Office recognizes the state of Minnesota as a single address. They will not come around to the various offices and pick up our mail. So we have a small staff over in the Department of Transportation building that do all of this work. They have trucks, and they come around and pick up the mail from all of the offices, and we collate it, and we save a tremendous... Last year, we saved $750,000 in postage simply by being able to bulk mail and address electronically. And so we do offer that service, but it is generally funded. Well, one of the things I might have to look at is less frequency of mail pickups and deliveries. I use that as an example only to say I don't have many more choices. I have data practices. I don't think anyone would advocate that we ought to reduce the small amount of technical staff we have in the data practices area. I have, those are the kinds of things that are generally funded that, recycling is, we think we have a fabulous recycling effort. It's over on Grove. We're very, very proud of our operation. But it is generally funded. And, might I have to reduce further that activity? It is not statutorily mandated. Much of what I do is statutorily mandated. And so those are areas that they are very, very difficult for me to look at reductions. So it's these, unfortunately, they're not pleasant, any of the areas that I might have to look at. I do not have to resort to that, however, if we stick with the 4% and I'm allowed to cut the 4% out of the total base.
Otherwise, Mr. Chair, Commissioner, otherwise you said it was a 13% cut?
Well, I mean, that really is outrageous, but it's if I added every single negative provision and took my share of the professional and technical contracts, it would amount to a 13% cut in my base. Now, that doesn't mention the fact that another provision in this bill eliminates my only deputy, my only assistant, and the director for the Drive to Excellence. I only have one of each, both of whom have significant responsibilities. One of them is running a $70 million property operation. I haven't even talked about that impact on the department. But if I start to do that, I swear I sound like I'm whining. I am not. We want to do what we can. We want to help with the solution in whatever ways that we can. And one of the ways that we do it is through making government more efficient. The kinds of things that we are doing in performance management and in the drive to excellence and in IT consolidation and in fleet consolidation and in real property management, those are all projects that are going to make us eventually more efficient. I know, but everybody wants us the payoff today. And that's a massive enterprise cultural change that we have undertaken that will, I guarantee you, ultimately result in a significantly streamlined government.
I just thought we were going to get rid of the waste, fraud, and inefficiency, although I haven't heard that yet this session. Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Badgerill, you commented about technical contract related to bonding and buildings.
Yes.
And how does that impact your agency financially? I was under the assumption that when we passed a bonding bill with money for building projects, that the money in the bonding bill paid for things like design. In fact, we sometimes list pre-designed design. So inform me about how that impacts negatively your department's budget.
Mr. Chair and Senator Frederickson, what used to be called the State Architect's Office, which we now call Real Estate and Construction Services, is generally funded. And those are the project managers that will be managing the resurfacing of the facade of the MnDOT building, for example. Now, the professional and technical side of it is the pre-design and design work that is pre the bonding request. So it is not a direct correlation. Well, it depends on how the term professional and technical contracts is calculated and how the Department of Finance chooses to allocate it to agencies. But of the amount that you mentioned, Mr. Mossman indicated, a substantial portion of that is for architect and engineering services, which may be paid for with bonding funds.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, how does PCA help you with recycling, or do they?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, we are very, very active with them, and they have the multi-agency group that is looking at energy reduction and conservation. They give us guidance and guidelines, but quite frankly, we think we have a world-class operation over here on Grove Street that is doing the recycling, and I welcome any of you to come see it at any time. We are very, very proud. We had a goal this year to increase recycling in the Capitol complex by 7%. You may know we had a little contest, building against building, and awarded little prizes. And we had a tremendous increase this last year. But we work with PCA only in that we follow their guidelines and they give us advice.
Okay, are there any other questions of the commissioner? Well, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Jordal Jared of the Department of Employee Relations, and I'm reminded now this is the department that's in the process of being merged. I think that takes place July 1st.
June 1,
okay. So if you could explain what the budget changes mean for you, at least at this point in time, and maybe what it means on into the future then.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Jared Jordal with the Department of Employee Relations. I actually am here to testify on a couple of provisions in the bill that have statewide impact versus Dewar impact solely. The first is the managerial cuts in both bills. The Senate, of course, reduces deputy commissioners and eliminates assistant commissioners and bank some savings from that. The House takes a lump of the deputy commissioners, the assistant commissioners, and 1A unclassified appointments and calls upon the elimination of 25% and doesn't bank any money. I ran some numbers yesterday. There are currently 25 deputy commissioners in state government. 32 are authorized. That amounts to a ratio across the executive branch workforce of about one deputy commissioner for every 2,152 employees. For assistant commissioners, there are 36 currently. There are 38 authorized. That amounts to a ratio of one assistant commissioner for every 1,494. 1A appointments, there's 96 currently, and that is one 1A appointment for every 560 state employees of the executive branch. In terms of the trend, in 1998, there were 28 commissioners. 2008, there are 25, so we're down three commissioners. We're soon to be down one more when Dewar goes away on June 1. Deputy commissioners, in 1998, there were 26. There's currently 25, so we're down one deputy commissioner. Assistant commissioners, in 1998, there were 48. And in 2008, there are 36, so we're down 12. In a nutshell, we don't feel that we're top-heavy on the state agencies, that we're pretty streamlined. Overall, on the managerial class, so to speak, that is being cut, at least in the House bill, of 1As and deputies and assistants, it amounts to one manager, as it were, for every 1,402 members of the state employee workforce. So the other issue I wanted to raise is a House provision. It's on it's the House in the side-by-side of the state government finance article. It's on page R30. It has to do with executive branch compensation. This was a bill from Senator Pappas and Representative Simon. I think there's a good deal of maybe confusion on this bill. This bill, it's policy, but it does have a fiscal impact. The bill does two things. It raises the salary cap for state agency heads to put state agency heads on par with political subdivisions, rather than being 95% of the governor's salary. The other thing it does is it adjusts compensation classes to bring them into what we call the corridor. There are about 1,900 classes in state government, state employment classes. 233 of them are judged to be below what we call the corridor. And of those, 190 of those classes are occupied currently. And it would raise those occupied classes, and that's where the fiscal note comes from. The fiscal note is the fiscal note does not reflect any change in agency head salaries, but it does reflect the requirement under the language of this article that's in the House language to raise up the 1,275 employees in those 190 state employment classes. And that is a statewide fiscal impact, and we don't feel that it's a good thing to do in times of deficit when the agencies are taking across-the-board cuts.
Quick question. The comments by the previous commissioner about the ability to attract and retain, in light of your comments you just made, if you could comment relative to that then.
Mr. Chair, we... it is quite true that the executive branch is very concerned about the state employee workforce. The average age of the state workforce is 48. We do have salary compression issues. We do have recruitment and retention issues. And, you know, it is an ongoing challenge to keep and motivate and recruit state employees. So we are keenly aware of many of these issues. The governor has issued an executive order that all agencies are to do workforce planning. Dewar is assisting with that. And, these issues are on the forefront. So you are correct.
Commissioner, that's the reason I raised the question, because I've had conversations separate from the hearings when these initiatives were going through the Finance Committee on the House side about that very concern, and that's the purpose of the language. So I hear what you're saying on the cost side, but there's also the problem, and you come up right after one of the commissioners identified that as one of the issues, but she's not the only one that has identified that as a big problem in state government.
It was fortuitous timing for me to come up after Commissioner Badgerow. I would agree with that.
Are there other questions? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Jordahl,
do you have just a blanket objection to those increases that you were saying this isn't the time for, or just the ones that would have affect the fiscal note would affect? Is there some that aren't paid for, or they're paid for in a different way?
Mr. Jordahl.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy. The fiscal note, as I said, it is quite confusing. The fiscal note is the actual cost to raise the classes. So there isn't. I'm not sure I'm understanding your question. I'm afraid we under the fiscal note there are 1,275 employees that would need to have their class that they're currently in adjusted. And they would go to a different range to be paid within what we call the corridor. And, you know, those jobs are seen as being underclassified in terms of the pay range that they're assigned to currently. And so, you know, the overall fiscal note is would affect different agencies differently depending on how many employees they have in those 233 classes that are being adjusted. And, you know, in terms of the objection to raising that, you know, we're talking about 233 classes, 190 of them have incumbents, have employees actually doing them. So 43 of the classes are currently empty. And we're talking about that number, 190, out of a total number of Minnesota job classes that amounts to about 1,900. So it's not a big deal, but it is, you know, in the grand scheme of things, the fiscal note is not horrendous, but it's difficult when every penny counts in a year like this one is what we feel.
Representative Murphy said. Any other questions of Mr. Jordahl? Okay, well, thank you.
I have on the list, but I don't have a name, the Office of Enterprise Technology.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just informed,
members.
It's Mr. Lally, right?
My name is John Lally. I'm Planning Director for the Office of Enterprise Technology. And I'm not going to speak to the cuts in the operating budget for OET. Needless to say, we're as excited about those as everybody else in this room. What I do want to talk to you about is something that was raised yesterday by Commissioner Hansen and several other speakers, and it's a special revenue fund in the Office of Enterprise Technology. When the legislature created OET 3 years ago and appointed, and when the governor appointed Gopal Khanna as our chief information officer, one of the themes we've started on then and continued is the idea of collaboration and the use of common resources across agencies. Instead of replicating systems in multiple agencies, we would have what we call shared systems that serve several agencies or utility systems that serve all agencies. And at that time, we put together a funding scheme for many of these common projects that would allow agencies to thoughtfully invest rather than spend money at the end of the year, put that money towards these common projects that none of them could afford to do individually, but that collectively we could make happen. And so 2 years ago, what is called the Information and Telecommunications Account, or the 200 Fund for short, was created. And there's very little of that money that is OET money. It comes from about 36, I believe, that by the current count, different agencies that have contributed over the last 2 years, $8 million, towards funding 13 enterprise-wide or shared services programs. And this is a very important concept, that this idea of working together toward common systems and trying to avoid the constant replication of systems across state agencies. In this past 2 years, those 13 systems have begun to unite agencies with common systems, common data, increased cooperation, and we're very much afraid of the chilling effect that taking this money that was contributed for those purposes out of this fund will have on those kind of collaborative efforts in the future. There's a practical problem. The Senate addressed, I think, $3.5 million in that fund to be captured, and in fact, there's less than $900,000. And that's because this is a pass-through account. Money comes in constantly, is encumbered and expended on these 13 systems projects that are in place. Our hope is that we'll have more of this in the future, but that certainly seems to be an unlikely prospect if this fund goes away as the result of the budget action this session.
Okay, does that conclude the your testimony,
That's our
Mr.
primary
Lally.
Concern.
Okay, are there questions of Mr. Lally? Okay, apparently we have none, so thank you very much. The next person is the Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Health, and that would be Margaret Kelly. And welcome.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Margaret Kelly, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Health. I want to first thank you for the opportunity to come before the conference committee this evening to talk about our concerns with the bill. I appreciate the work and challenge you have ahead of you in getting a bill put out. I'd just like to comment on two fiscal provisions in the bill. First is the level of administrative reductions in the Senate bill versus the House bill. The Senate bill aligns more closely with the governor's budget in that it provides for a 4% administrative reduction, and the House bill provided for a 6% administrative reduction. And we support and encourage you to consider the equity across state agencies in both the governor in the governor's proposal. The second provision that I'd like to talk about is the language in the House bill that directs the commissioner on how specifically she should make administrative reductions, specifically identifying which positions to eliminate and to reduce travel and to protect federal funds. And first, let me say that my priority and the commissioner's priority for managing administrative reductions will be in the spirit of the House language. We certainly want to protect programmatic activities at the expense of administrative support. But having said that, the implementation language in the House bill will significantly challenge our ability to manage a reduction. Some level of administrative spending is essential to supporting programmatic activity at the department. And if we were to eliminate travel, we would render some of our programs ineffective. Our investigations of disease outbreaks, our disaster response during floods or other emergencies, our community relations on emerging environmental issues, and our many inspections and regulatory responsibilities, to name a few, necessitate travel. In addition, travel reductions would put our federal funding at risk. The majority of our travel is in response to federal requirements, and not meeting these requirements would put our federal grants in jeopardy, and the language directs us to protect those federal grants. Finally, this language assumes that activity supported by a federal grant is of greater value than general funded activity. While federal grants do represent almost 50% of our budget, and they allow us to do critical public health activities that are not supported by the general fund does support critical activities for which there is no other funding source: rabies investigations, TB medications and case management, and our public health laboratory management, to name a few activities. It is important for our commissioner to have the flexibility to manage the reductions in a way that maintains critical public health activities. Those are the two concerns we have, and I would just like to support comments made by both Commissioner Badgero and Director Lally in OET. We are one of the agencies that has taken advantage of the lean process improvement that the Department of Administration has made available. And through that process, we have made numerous efficiencies in the way we do our business. And without the support of their department, we would not have probably been able to enter into those activities. That's the end of my testimony.
I have a question. I'm looking at our side-by-sides here, and there's reference here to the to travel and the testimony you provided. It's a relatively short paragraph. It's, the Department of Health must implement this reduction in a manner that does not result in the loss of federal funds. So it seems that Representative Clark's division in the House, which crafted this language, wanted to make sure that you didn't jeopardize federal funds. So that it's not an absolute ban on travel in that regard. All budget reductions must be made with an emphasis on cutting administrative and overhead expenses, including but not limited to outstate travel, in-state travel, compensation supplies, and so on, but with as little impact as possible on programs and services. So it sounds to me like that language is saying take a good hard look at the travel, do what's necessary, but be frugal in doing it. I mean, it's not a – there have been times in state government history where there's been virtually a total ban, especially on travel out of state. But as I read this language, it seems to me to be saying you do a good, thorough review of travel and you do what's necessary to maximize your federal funds as well as provide the services you alluded to. If you'd care to comment on how you, with your testimony, seem to interpret it and how at least I'm interpreting it as I read the language.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that. Clearly, our approach to taking reductions would be to maximize federal dollars, would be to ensure programmatic activity could continue, would be to scrutinize every administrative dollar that we spend. And in the spirit of that language, we will do that. Our concern is that with that language on the book, if we do make a programmatic activity, it will be considered to be done in violation of the law.
Okay, are there questions of Ms. Kelly? Representative Wagenius.
It does sound as though you're considering a change in programmatic activity. Would you care to share with us what would be at the top of your list?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I didn't hear the first part of your question.
Just listening to your testimony, it seems that if you want the opportunity to be able to change some programmatic activity, that you must have something in mind. And so I was asking if you'd care to share what you had at the top of your list.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, at this point in time, we are looking at what our options are across the department, and we are looking primarily focusing on administrative efficiencies that we can achieve, both in our technology area, in our facilities management area, in our HR area, and those sorts of reductions would be my top priority. However, we may not be able to achieve the level of reduction we need to just looking at those things and may need to look at other activities more programmatic in nature across the department. And we don't have a priority in looking at what those would be.
Representative Wagenius?
It would be perhaps more persuasive to us, or to me at least, if you could tell us what might happen, but it, without knowing that, it's hard to criticize the language that was written.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I could certainly put the Washington Monument on the table, and I would hate to do that as a scare tactic. I would hate to talk about programmatic reductions that we may consider making and announce them here in a public committee hearing without having talked internally with department staff. And quite frankly, we haven't had any internal discussions yet about what reductions we would make. And my suggesting anything might be premature, but if you'd like to talk more about that, I'm not quite sure what I would offer.
Ms. Kelly, I'm a bit surprised that there hasn't been any internal discussions. Have you had discussions with the commissioner? I would assume with what's on the table in your testimony here, you've had some discussion with somebody, if not the commissioner, other top staff, but I would assume the commissioner would have taken a good look at what was put on the table. It's not that it's news tonight, and you did prepare some testimony, so there must have been something that was cleared to someplace or some dialogue, if you will.
Mr. Chair, certainly we have had many discussions internally about how we would manage a reduction. We did propose reductions. The governor's budget proposes reductions, and we've been planning how we would manage those reductions, not knowing what the level would be. We have not had formal conversations with staff beyond the executive level and the division managers in the department. We've asked managers to put options on the table or suggestions on the table that would provide for administrative reductions in nature and protect programmatic activity. And the most work that I have done to date is around changes we can make in the way we provide our infrastructure around our IT services to see what administrative savings we can wring out of that, so that we can then look to see what savings we need to look to other programmatic activities for.
Yeah, I have to say that sounds a little better. I was left with the impression that there had been no discussions. I think what you're really saying, there's been no decisions made, but hopefully an agency that would have known for some time, you know, the governor's budget has been out there, the legislative budget's now been out there for some time, and I was having difficulty imagining that you wouldn't have had some dialogues about what you might do with the commissioner, recognizing she's relatively new, but with other staff as well. Okay, there are other questions. Representative Osmond.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd just like to compliment you on that approach. I know coming out of government and management at the local level, I knew the way to demoralize my troops was to really try to put together a plan and put on the table every time the city council came up with a proposal for drafting or for reducing activities. And when you start talking programs or you start talking specifics, you can demoralize the people real quick. I appreciate your broader approach.
And Representative Osmond, I think that's what I was. I was just left with the impression there had been no dialogue, and I would assume at the leadership level there had to have been, and she confirmed that there was. So I, like you, I think I'm complimentary of the approach she's using, then as long as there was this dialogue, that's what I wanted to clarify. This is Commissioner Kelly. Yep.
Other questions, comments for the commissioner? Okay, well, thank you very much. Okay, then the last agency that I have on the list is kind of, well, you know, as they say, last but not least, given the nature of our bill, Health and Human Services. Commissioner Wilkin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Tim Wilkin.
You know, Commissioner, before we get started, you know, Representative Carlson and I were trying to count the former House members that have appeared in front of us over these last
and
couple
staff.
Of days, and staff, you know, Commissioner Anderson from Education, and we only and the House members far outnumbered the Senate. We only came up with two judges, I think, and that was it. So glad to have another former House member.
Appreciate the welcome.
As a former House member.
And I was just going to say, and Mr. Chairman, don't forget that you do have that same background,
yes,
as well.
Yep.
They also served with all the House members here and Senator Tomasoni when he was in the House, too. So thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'd first like to acknowledge the many items we have in common with both the House and Senate bills. That obviously gives us a good base to start from and makes what is a painful process a little bit easier. We do have a few concerns that we want to share with you. And some of these surround the fiscal note process in the Senate. There were several items that did not go through the fiscal note process. Many of the numbers were not produced by our department, and none of these that I will speak of were reviewed by the Department of Finance. The first item that I'd like to speak to is the managed care administration cap. And this requires the department to limit administrative costs paid to managed care plans and county-based purchasing to an overall average of 7%. The aggregate average for the plans is currently 8.6%, so that requires a reduction of 1.6%. Those administrative costs also include the 1% premium tax and an HMO surcharge, which equals about 6.6%, which leaves about 5.4% for admin activities.
Maybe just so I understand what you meant by this one with the lack of, you're saying what the bill books is not reflective of what your numbers would be. So what would be your net if you might share, as you mentioned with the managed care? Well, you threw some numbers out there, and I wasn't sure where the bottom line was.
Right. The net, if this was through, would be for actual admin, excluding the taxes, would be 5.4%. Part of the point with bringing this up, however, is that when you cap the administration activities, you run into an actuarial soundness issue. And we have to, through an outside actuary, certify that our rates are actuarially sound in order to be approved by CMS. So we wouldn't be able to prove these savings that are in your tracking.
And I guess, Mr. Chairman, if I may, I just want to clarify as we're getting started, because so when you say 5.4% net, what would be a dollar number that you would attach to that? Because I'm looking at the budget book.
Well, that.
Can you do that?
I don't know that we can do that.
Or do we just talk a percent? I'm trying to translate what you're saying in terms of dollars.
Mr. Chair and members, the numbers on the Senate tracking reflect what a 1.6% reduction in managed care rates would be. This is a calculation that was provided by the department. The issue we have is the level of risk that is associated with the proposal. And that the level of cap in the proposal is at such a level that we don't think we would be able to meet actuarial soundness, and therefore we could not, the risk would be too high to meet actuarial soundness. We don't think we could get the rates certified and therefore could not stand by these numbers as being viable savings. But the numbers in the tracking do represent 1.6%.
Okay, that helps. I was a little confused when Mr. Wilkins was putting those numbers out there in terms of how that would translate. So I think I have a grasp of what you were saying now.
The numbers on tracking tie to the percent cut. It's just that they don't leave us with an actuarially sound rate basis.
Okay. And I understand, Mr. Chairman.
Well, and Ms. Julek, could you just identify yourself for the record?
I'm sorry. Barb Julek, Department of Human Services.
Okay, thanks. And for the record, a former Senate staffer. So,
you're catching up.
We're still far behind. So
we tried to provide balance at the department. The next item is in line with the last one. It's the recapture of managed care reserves. And what this proposal does is requires the department to reduce HMO administrative rates by an amount equal to 50% of the reserves above a threshold that is set in the bill. That threshold set based on percentage of risk-based capital. I believe it's 550% of risk-based capital. There are a number of problems with this, and it goes back to the same issue in the prior one, in that there's problems with the actuarial soundness. We can't separate prepaid rates into administrative and medical costs. When the actuaries review the rates, they have to stand alone on a prospective basis. So for the next contract period, the rates have to be actuarially sound, and they cannot look back retroactively to recapture the funds that were expended in prior years. If we don't get them actuarially sound, then we stand the risk of not being, we would not be certified by CMS to approve these rates, and that would put the forecast at risk. The next item is the prior authorization piece. This requires us to review lists from Oregon and Washington states, but the language does not give us any additional authority to implement prior authorization beyond what was approved in 2005 when we approved certain prior authorization through the Health Services Advisory Committee. Those savings are booked in the current forecast, so there's really no additional savings that can be booked in that piece. The next item is third-party liability. The provision for third-party liability tracks $6 million in annual savings for what's called additional activities in the language. It doesn't specify any specific additional activities that we take, and so that we can't really fiscal note unspecified additional activities. We're certainly willing to consider new approaches that might be out there and improve what we are doing currently. Minnesota does have one of the most mature third-party liability collection systems in the country. We've been doing this for 24 years in the department, and we gather in about $120 million a year currently. So we're looked at by CMS as one of the leaders in this currently. So unless we get some specific activities that can be proven to bring in additional monies, we can't fiscal note it. The final of these items in this category is the sex offender program. The problem with this item is you can specify an amount to be saved there. Unfortunately, for 2009, we're struggling through a current deficit in the sex offender program of $12 million. And we've brought in an experienced executive from the Department of Corrections to work on this program. We believe that we can work through it. That's why you don't have an appropriation request in front of you to fill that gap. We're working on bringing our per diem rates and our expenses in this program down. But adding to those that deficit would create quite a bit of uncertainty in that program and could impact staff and patient safety. Our new staff has reviewed the area, and they're working through in a very thoughtful and methodical approach to reduce the current deficit, and they believe they can hit that target, but adding to it would be a difficulty. And leaving those items, those were the ones where we had problems with the fiscal process. I now have a couple items that are federal compliance issues that are in a different category. The first one is payment to public providers. This is included in the House bill, but not in the Senate bill. It's based on federal regulations that take effect next month. And without this language, we'd have a conflict between state and federal law, and we'd have to be reviewing these public providers to make sure that we're not paying in excess of cost. I would point out that there is some talk that Congress might repeal this or put a hold on it. The language that we provided does include a provisional so that if the feds do that, we don't have to implement it. So we would appreciate that piece being included. The next is also a federal compliance piece. It's on, it's regarding federal disallowance, and it's not compliance per se, but it has the danger of additional general fund costs, and it would disallow us from recouping disallowances from the feds, recouping the money from the counties. So if we don't recoup it from the counties, it's coming out of the general fund. That would also create a disparity between how we treat Medicaid providers between the counties and other providers who we can recoup those payments from.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, is that the issue where some of the counties underpaid? And now we're trying to get them to repay what they thought they didn't have to pay?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, no, that's a different item. County overspending on some of the waiver programs, and that's in a different area of the budget. I believe the Senate picked that up and the House didn't, but that's not on our list for discussion today.
Thank you. Sorry.
The other area is in the administrative cuts, and this is more to point out the cumulative effect of those. I think both bodies accepted equally the governor's recommendation of the 4% cut, and also, for the most part, we also have an additional amounts to an additional administrative burden we're taking on by absorbing all of our federal compliance issues. In what normally, in a normal year, we'd request an allotment to cover those federal costs. This year, we've proposed that we will absorb that amount. However, when we get into the additional cuts that are proposed for professional technical contracts and the cuts for OET, that adds on another layer of additional expense for the department. I realize that it's not specified per se, but the Department of Human Services, being quite large, would probably take on a rather large portion of those cuts. Finally, I want to address the Healthcare Access Fund. The Healthcare Access Fund is projected to have quite a large surplus. The surplus is made up of primarily one-time money. And I know the health care reform bills are not in this committee, but they're obviously heavily on your mind as they will affect targets for yourselves and that committee. The House and Senate health care reform bills that passed will create significant structural deficits of about $130 million plus annually by 2011. The governor has proposed a one-time transfer of $250 million from the Healthcare Access Fund to the General Fund. I realize that's an issue for many on this committee and in the legislature. I do want to point out that 92% of the healthcare programs from the Department of Human Services are paid for out of the General Fund. That's out of $8 billion, that's about $7.5 billion that are paid for out of the general fund rather than the healthcare access fund. This represents programs like medical assistance, alternative care, general assistance medical care, and chemical dependency treatment. That compares to just about 8% that is paid out of the healthcare access fund. So we feel that moving $250 million from the Healthcare Access Fund to the General Fund is justified based on the heavy burden of health care that is paid for out of the General Fund.
But, Commissioner, can I ask relative to that? I understand the disparity between General Fund and the amount of the Healthcare Access Fund, but wasn't the Healthcare Access Fund revenue predicated upon usage directly for Medicare and healthcare access? I mean, wasn't that the agreement in 92? I don't know that anybody at this table was involved in the promulgation of that legislation. Obviously, Senator Berglund was. Some of us were in the legislature then, but I wasn't involved in any significant way with the passage of the legislation. But wasn't that 2% provider tax passed with the intent that it would be utilized only for healthcare access purposes?
Mr. Chairman, I wasn't here at that time either. I do believe it was for healthcare purposes, and some would probably say specifically for Minnesota Care. We believe that we are using it for healthcare purposes still, just healthcare that's out of the general fund. Over the years, there have been many changes in the healthcare access fund. Most recently, there was a change that moved some general assistance medical care populations to the healthcare access fund, and that was bifurcated somewhat in that there's a transitional Minnesota care program where it's paid for, partially paid for out of the general fund for the first few months while they get moved to the Minnesota care program, thus being paid out of the healthcare access fund. So there have been changes, and I know the House makes certain refinancings with healthcare access fund. I think it's somewhere around $20-22 million in healthcare access fund dollars that are being used to refinance things that are currently paid out of the general fund.
Well, and I appreciate that. I recognize we're not going to resolve that tonight. That certainly, you know, if you take a look at our respective Senate and House bills, the most significant difference between the legislature and the governor is the usage of the health care access fund. And I say that not, well, I guess I say it in a little bit of a critical way, but more so as a statement of fact. I think everybody admits that. And so recognize that that's an issue that we're not going to resolve tonight, but will certainly be a key to resolving the budget and how we end the session.
Mr. Chairman, just to finish up, there are a few other technical and implementation issues that we have, but we can work with the working groups on that. They don't rise to the level of bringing up to you right now. That concludes my formal remarks, and be happy to answer any questions that you have.
And let me just make another general comment. I appreciate your comments this evening. I know, as you indicate, there are some differences with the Senate bill, probably in particular. But I know that the department's been working with Senator Berglund and Senate staff to try to see if we can narrow some of the differences, and I appreciate, you know, the time that everybody's put into that from your agency, and hope that maybe in these next several days we can try to resolve some of that where we're all using the same figures and think we all make some sense. So I appreciate the time that that your folks have spent with ours.
Thank you.
Other Representative Carlson.
I'll yield for a moment.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Wilkin, do you have any concerns about child care?
Mr. Chairman, I think the only provision that I am aware of off the top of my head about child care is there's a provision in the Senate bill that uses about $9 million in child care funds. Is that the one you're referring to?
I was just wondering what you thought.
It's, Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, we don't have any proposals on the table right now for that, and we realize that the committee is going to need all the tools they have in front of them.
Other Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I don't know how much longer we're going to be here, but I have asked Mr. Marks to check on the statute if we have time. Otherwise, we may raise the question later. I became very curious on at least the title. And the discussions I've had over the years, I was not part of that group of six that put together with Governor Carlson the health care access fund, but I've always had a certain understanding, and the title would imply it was to provide access, and so we're seeing if maybe the statute could give us a little guidance there, but I was a bit surprised when you used the phrase health care purposes. I mean, that would be wide open and totally different than what I have had as an understanding through the years when different issues would surface relative to the health care access fund. But well, perhaps if you can hang around until we adjourn and revert back if we get a copy of that statute. The other question, Mr. Chairman, I had, I'm just still on that list of at least the first four items you listed. Not sure if you're saying if any savings could be booked there. I think when we were looking at the Senate numbers as you were talking, that totaled about $52 million. So I think you were very clear that that can't be achieved, but I'm still kind of going back to that first question, and I think I understood what you were saying, what level of risk and what have you. But out of those four items, can you book any savings or not? And then one in particular I'm kind of wondering about, because in addition to being involved as chair of the Finance Committee, I happen to serve on the Tax Committee, and when we're talking about collections there, we get pretty good information from Department of Revenue. In fact, we are investing here. You know, if we invest X number of dollars for tax collection purposes, they can give us some numbers as to how much additional revenue that will generate. And over the years, that's dropped. You know, there was a huge payback and earlier, and then it's diminished some as we get more and more tax compliance. Are you saying then that, being that you're collecting the $120 million, I think it was in your testimony, that perhaps even with some additional investment or additional activity that you can't generate any more there? Because I think the Senate has it booked at $6 million, is what your testimony was. So are you telling us that well is dry, or that you can't do six but you can do something else, or that you would need an investment in staffing or something to increase those collections? Like I say, relative to revenue, you're leaving me a little confused on that one, that there can't be something perhaps there that could be collected.
Yeah. Commissioner. Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, I'll try to be a little more clear on that. The language that was in the Senate bill didn't define any specific activities. It talked about additional activities. If they're not specific, they're hard to book. We're certainly ready and willing to evaluate any additional techniques for collecting additional funds. Anything that we can say, look at specifically and analyze and prove that they can book savings. We're more than happy to work with the House and Senate authors and try to come up with something, because that would certainly be a preferable option. But we were just referring to the bill that is before us.
I'll stop. See what we've got here. It's not
going to be the language as written. No, we are working on options. So.
And Commissioner, I've been told, if I understand correctly, that at least relative to collections, you have some kind of RFP out to try to seek increased collections. Is that?
Yeah, we'll ask Jan Taylor. She'd be more familiar with the RFP.
Okay, Ms. Taylor?
Yes. Hello, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Yes, we have published an RFP, and we're in the process of we've received one response to the RFP, and we will be making a decision fairly soon as to whether or not we would seek to reissue the RFP or go forward with the current proposals and the full evaluation of those proposals.
And what were you expecting with the issuance of the RFP?
We, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, frankly, we were expecting multiple multiple proposals, and we're somewhat surprised that there was just one. We know of a number of firms that conceivably, you know, requested copies of the RFP and might have been interested and would seem to be meet the requirements. But at this point, having only received the one proposal, that's kind of where we're left at this point.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I think the question that I was interested in with the healthcare access and the statute references so many other areas of law that I think it would take more research than we could get at the table here. But I think I would make the request of House Research. And the other thing, it's referencing session law, but several other statutes. So I think that may be an important question to to try to get some information on. So we'll have to defer that until later. Thank you.
Okay. Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, when I said healthcare purposes, I wasn't meaning to make a distinction between that and access. I believe that MA and alternative care and GAMC, they're all about also providing access to healthcare.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that clarifies it a little bit, because when I wrote down, you know, the comment was healthcare purposes, and I that could be pretty broad.
Yes, I agree.
Other questions for Commissioner Wilkin? Okay. Well, thank you very much for all of your time. Let me just ask then, that's the last agency head that we have on our agenda. Are there other agencies that have not been given an opportunity to testify? Okay. Let me also ask, Representative Carlson and I had talked about wanting to make sure that if members had questions where they were seeking testimony, that we would afford members an opportunity. I don't know if there are people here in the public who would like to testify for a minute about the bill. I don't know if anybody wishes to do so, or if members have questions that they want to direct at individuals that have not testified. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, one suggestion I might make is, and there's obviously a lot fewer people here tonight, although this hearings go a relatively large group, but not compared to what we started out with.
The excitement's kind of gone down, I think.
Yeah, as we've gone through the different agencies. Yeah. But one thing I was going to suggest that I would be interested in, and maybe others, if members of the public or the various agency heads and so on have additional comments, if you could submit a brief, keeping in mind how massive this issue is here with the issues that are before us, but maybe a one-page memo that would outline any suggestions that you would have to help resolve the problem, I'll put it that way, and or issues that you have concerns about. But that might be another way of submitting some concerns and or thoughts on how to help resolve the budget.
And I would concur with that. And if members, if conferees know of people who have not had a chance to testify, might not be here this evening, if you could convey that to those individuals as well.
And Mr. Chairman, I did have, when I left the room a little bit ago for a short moment, we had the Department of Revenue requested that they would like to testify the next time we meet. The commissioner just simply wasn't able to be here tonight. I know there was a House Tax Committee going on at the same time. I'm not sure if that's where he was or not, but he did make the request and said he would be here at our next meeting.
Yeah, I forgot to mention Commissioner Innes, a former Senate staffer, was here, I think, yesterday and not available tonight, and we do want to listen to him relative to the compliance pieces that we have in the Senate and House bills. So we certainly want to give Commissioner Innes a chance to testify at the outset of our next hearing.
Tomorrow after session. And then Bill Mark's going to run through some of the numbers for us on the revenue, non-tax revenue that's in the bill. He's available to do that.
Then we assume we'll
see what the feedback is.
All right. What we'd like to do is to meet tomorrow, subsequent to what, half hour after adjournment of the last House? Are we okay in terms of, pardon? Yeah, a half hour after the last body adjourns. And Mr. Marks is going to spend some time with us tomorrow on, and Mr. Mossman, on the revenues. We'll make sure if somebody could get in touch with Commissioner Innes to make sure we have him at the outset of the agenda.
Chairman, when you mentioned revenues, I think it's important for interested parties to distinguish. I think what they're prepared for tomorrow is non- tax revenue thing.
Yeah.
Just so we're clear for the audience what that will be.
Yeah, I don't want